This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're talking now about the recent death. Just heard this in the last hour about the death of Nelson Mandela, who died at home today. He was 95 years old.
He spent 27 years in prison, led the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, and ultimately became its first black president.
Millions around the world are beginning the mourning process. And here to discuss Mandela's life and legacy is Cyan Loyal, professor of politics at West Virginia University, where her research interests include African politics and transitional justice. Cyan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica.
First off, what is going through your mind right now with this news that Nelson Mandela has died?
Well, absolutely a great sadness. You know, he was one of the probably most prominent human rights crusaders and leaders of our time, and the world has really lost a special human being today.
What in particular did he mean to Africa?
Well, I mean, Mandela is one of the great crusaders for dignity and equality of all people, and he pursued that agenda independent of race, of class, of political affiliation, and that was really a message, I think, that resonated for people in Africa, but also people globally.
And you talked about what he meant as a crusader to the world. What do you think his prominent legacy will be as people start to look back and think about his many accomplishments over the years?
Yeah, I mean, I think his greatest legacy most certainly will be the peaceful transition of South Africa. He fought hard for a peaceful solution, and when he saw that as the best option for the country and its people, he really turned away from violence and was able to negotiate a transition that I think many people wouldn't have been able to do and really averted, I think most people would argue, a civil war in that country.
One of the important things I always wonder about is the peaceful transition for him coming into the presidency, but also a peaceful transition with him leaving the presidency and passing the reins to someone else. How important that is an example to countries going through transitions elsewhere in the world?
Oh, Rob, that's huge. And there are very few leaders in Africa, but even leaders globally that went into power with so much popular support, with so much global support, and then willingly left power. I mean, it calls to mind images of people like George Washington in the U.S. I think it's an important legacy and one that other African leaders should certainly take example of.
His political accomplishments are huge, but something else people point to when they talk about why they love Mandela and why they're inspired by him is his time on Robben Island and how he dealt with those 27 years. Can you talk about what that time was like and how he overcame to a certain extent?
Yeah, I mean, of course. I think, anybody would argue that it must be very difficult to spend 27 years in prison and certainly is the type of experience that's designed to crush someone's spirit. And by all writings and by all evidence, that's not what happened to Mandela. He was actually able to use that time. He did language study, did education. He wrote a lot, and he even developed his political manifesto away from a manifesto of violence to one of political consolidation and negotiation with the white Africans in South Africa at the time. There's been some great films, there's been some great books about that period, and certainly is kind of the stuff of myth or legend.
Maybe it's too soon to be doing this, but is it fair to say that Mandela was one of the greatest political leaders in modern history?
Well, as a student of African politics, I would certainly make that argument. I think his legacy is insurmountable on the continent. For his peaceful transition from power, you know, for actually stepping out of office, but also, again, for being a real global leader, particularly in the South, but all throughout sub-Saharan Africa, both helping negotiate transitions in other countries, negotiate an end to the civil war in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. Mandela was very influential in both the political and economic development of the area during his time in office, but also after he left office. He's been a real global statesman ever since.
We'll leave it there for now. Cyan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it.
That's Cyan Loyal, professor of politics at West Virginia University. She researches African politics.
And just to close, a couple lines from one of Mandela's favorite poems, if I've got my history right. It's called Invictus. And the two that I remember, out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul.
And still checking on this, but I believe we'll have a special on the life of Nelson Mandela coming up here on the Ideas Network after 6. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And most of us can remember the first time we watched Walt Disney's movie Bambi. It's a story of man invading wildlife habitats with development and overhunting.
That was indeed the story of man's relationship with wildlife in America during the 19th and early 20th centuries. Americans overhunted a lot of kinds of wildlife. At the turn of the century, white-tailed deer were nearly extinct.
Our guest says those days are well behind us and that these days we're seeing an overpopulation of animals like deer, raccoons, and even bears and beavers. These animals have crept into suburban and sometimes even urban areas and have increased car accidents and caused damage to property. David Vondrili says the answer is that it's time to cull the herd and expand hunting permits. David's the author of several books. His article, America's Pest Problem, is the cover story of this month's issue of Time magazine. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, so 50 years ago, humans had pushed a lot of wildlife to the margins, in some cases to the point of extinction. What is the state right now of suburban and urban wildlife?
There are now more white-tailed deer, for example, living in the United States of America than there were living in that same piece of real estate when Columbus sailed the ocean blue. In other words, even though our population is now over 300 million human beings, deer are doing better than they ever have before. The similar stories can be told about wild pigs, about beavers, about black bears. It's said that there are now probably more mountain lions in the western United States than at any time in the history of the continent. So it's an amazing success story, this change from a nation that worshipped Buffalo Bill, the slaughterer of bison, 100 years ago, to a nation that now lives in closer proximity to more wild animals than probably at any time in our history. But it is beginning to cause some serious problems for humans, but also for the animals themselves.
Well, if you look at the rise of urban wildlife and suburban wildlife, maybe 10 years ago, it was viewed as this new phenomenon that was, it was kind of a cause for celebration, the idea being that humans took over the habitat, annihilated wildlife food sources. But then, look, nature is resilient. They were back. We had hawks and foxes and coyotes in suburbs and cities. Why is that narrative turning on us a little bit now?
Well, because there's even more of them than there were 10 years ago. And as I say, it's a danger not just to us. I mean, it's over a million car accidents with deer, for example, every year, causing $4 billion of repairs, leaving an average of about 200 humans dead every year. But those same accidents leave over a million deer dead every year. You drive down the roads now across the country and you see the carcasses of deers, raccoons, possums, all over the sides of the roads, and even occasionally bears and other large animals that have been killed. We've had cougars that have had to be shot in the middle of the city of Chicago not long ago. Just this week, a woman outside Orlando was mauled by a black bear just outside her house. So these interactions, which I agree with you, they're fantastic. I mean, in my neighborhood of Kansas City, my kids have seen all sorts of wildlife right in their own backyard. But we have created this situation, and now, as difficult as it is for those of us who love animals to face up to it, it's our responsibility to manage the situation in a way that allows us to coexist.
Okay, so you're talking about management there. What does that mean? What are we talking about when we say manage?
It means responsible hunting by, you know, well-trained and licensed hunters, more of it. And, you know, that's tough to say. And since we've published this article, I've heard, you know, some really heartfelt responses from people who, like me, grew up with that Bambi image of the hunter in the woods as a menace to the state of nature. But, you know, those million-plus deer that are being killed by cars every year are just as dead as deer that would be killed by hunters, and it can be done in a way that that creates the right number of animals in relation to what has become a very hospitable human society for wildlife.
Now, if we can get past the image, of killing Bambi, like you talked about, which a lot of people have a knee-jerk reaction against, maybe not necessarily in Wisconsin where there is a lot of hunting, but you're talking about hunting in cities and suburbs. How does that pass muster as something that's going to be a safe alternative?
Well, it has to be. This is why it's important to have, a mature, unsentimental conversation about it, because urban hunting does have the potential to be dangerous. It can't be done without a lot of thought. But in places where they are taking a thoughtful approach, they're proving that it can be done effectively and safely. Generally, it's limited to bow hunters only. In the cases where, and they're required to hunt from elevated stands so that the arrows are pointing downward toward the earth. So if they miss, they end up hitting the ground. In some cases, very highly trained sharpshooters are licensed to hunt in areas that are cleared of human beings to avoid accidents. But this is why we're calling for an open and, as I say, unsentimental discussion of this problem.
We're talking about how to deal with the huge numbers of wildlife that are now living in urban and suburban areas. We're talking with David Mondrilli, editor-at-large for Time magazine. His article in this month's issue of Time is called America's Pest Problem.
And we'd like to hear your experiences. Have you noticed more deer, raccoons, other animals growing more common in your neck of the woods? Have you seen them in suburban, even urban areas? Do you think we should consider more hunting, as our guest suggests, or other options? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll take your calls after a look at headlines. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're back with David Mondrilli talking about his new Time magazine cover story, America's Pest Problem, talking about deer, raccoons, muskrats, a lot of other creatures that a lot of people find are nuisances, especially in suburban, even urban environments. Part of his solution, a cull, hunting carefully in suburban, even city areas.
And we'd love to hear what you think about this. Have you noticed problems with deer, maybe here in Wisconsin, with raccoons, with other animals that may be growing more common? We've been hearing about episodes with bears and issues with maulings in other parts of the state. What do you think is the solution? Do you think that we need to learn to live alongside these new larger populations of wildlife, or is controlled culling the answer? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And David, I want to ask you, what has the creation of the suburbs done to maybe contribute to the problem of these huge wildlife populations?
Well, it's an interesting, complicated story. Initially, if you look at the original suburbs, say Levittown on Long Island, or the Hoffman Heights suburb outside Denver where I was born, what you had was former farmlands and forests clear-cut, and lots of little postage stamp houses, planted in row after row after row after row. And this was quite devastating for wildlife in those areas because it was very inhospitable. If you look at the way suburbs are built now, there's all sorts of green space woven through a typical American suburb of today, so that you'll have treed areas and meadow and this kind of a varied geography right alongside the houses. And what this has done is it's been great for the wildlife, because it allows them to live in a forest but come right out and do their dining at these fabulous buffets that we plant in our yards, vegetable gardens and flowering trees and fruit trees and these great big delicious cans of yummy garbage that we put out once a week, the succulent grease that we cake on our backyard barbecue grills. We've turned the suburbs into a 24-hour buffet for wildlife, and as a result, there's more of them, but they're also closer to us. So it's both good and bad for the wildlife and for us trying to live with them.
So the living is easy in the suburbs, and that's where they go. All right, well, let's go to the phone lines now. We've got Ryan with us from Menasha. Hi, Ryan.
Hello. Yeah, I was just calling because I know a couple of different areas in Little Chute, Combined Locks, or in those areas, Tacoma. There's actually a very large deer herd in the town area because, and in the city, because there's a little ravine that goes through there and they know that they're safe in there.
Mm-hmm.
Several people that I know actually have had deer die, by drowning in their pools and different areas like that. And like you had said, destroying their landscaping and such.
And what do you think about the idea of having hunting, you know, within some of these city and municipal boundaries?
I think it's a great idea. I think there should be some, you know, strict legislation on how they do it and the process. But I know that there's ways to do that and to do it safely. And I think that would be a great idea. It would really eliminate some of those problems.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Ryan. Appreciate that. And David, that sounds probably like a typical thing. The deer are just getting into backyards. I don't know if you've heard stories about drowning deer in swimming pools, but clearly
a lot
of deer.
It's the deer in the swimming pool is becoming a pretty frequent story, and so is the deer in the living room. We tell the story in the article about a woman outside Pittsburgh in the suburbs there. 83-year-old woman who heard a crash one morning and went into her hallway to find two adult white-tailed deer coming down the hall toward her. She screamed, slammed the door, you know, activated her emergency medical alert, and by the time the police arrived, they found her plate glass window was, you know, shattered. The adult deer were gone, but there was a terribly frightened fawn trapped in her living room. So it's a complicated matter, and it's traumatizing and difficult for the animals as well as for the humans. And that's the important thing to remember, that this is not just, you know, Bambi and Thumper happy in the woods and people intruding on their lives. It's difficult as well for species that would be living in our neighborhoods if there weren't overpopulation of certain animals. For example, if you have too many white-tailed deer grazing in a woodland, they will eat all of the songbird habitat, and you won't have any songbirds in that woods. Now, nature, without human beings, has ways of controlling these problems, and they are not friendly ways. They involve predators, and they involve starvation. And we have also completely eliminated those problems in the lives of deer and bears and raccoons and all these other animals. We have driven out the apex predators like lions and grizzly bears and wolves, because we don't want to live with them in our suburbs. And at the same time, we've provided this overabundance of yummy food for these animals to eat. And so it's not a state of nature out there that humans are somehow intruding on. It's a man-made environment that is creating these overpopulation problems.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Randy is with us next in Marshfield. Hi, Randy.
Hello.
What do you think?
I have an interesting story to talk to you about, but I just want to tell you this has a bad ending. the black bear ended up being shot by the Marshfield Police Department. But to the credit of the Wisconsin DNR and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the agents that worked with me, we tried very hard, and the community tried very hard to remove this bear for two springs. He hibernated under an abandoned warehouse, and we used culvert traps on my property, foot lassos. The DNR wasn't too keen on trying to trank the bear, but because they were worried about him being treed and falling out of the tree and then having to destroy the bear. But what was amazing to me is I put out a game camera and captured pictures of this creature, and I never realized how playful bears are. He played with soccer balls in my backyard. I was never threatened by the bear. In fact, when I came home and he was back there, if he noticed me, he would usually, go to a tree.
So why did he have to be? Why did he have to be destroyed, Randy?
Well, I tell you what happened is he became so acclimated to the city environment, and there was plenty of food for him. He was not interested in going into the culvert trap. He wasn't hungry enough. And, we asked people not to feed him, but people did anyhow. Marshfield is a city of 20,000 people, and it's hard to get them to all, do the same thing. But eventually the police felt that he was too much of a nuisance and was getting way too comfortable with the habitat, and he was treated, and they unfortunately had to shoot him. And I agree with the police. I think that he was a big bear, a very big bear.
Okay.
In fact, what we did is I asked the school if they were interested in for their animal display a bear carcass, and the Wisconsin DNR was very generous and donated it to me, and I had it taxidermied and displayed at the school as part of our natural habitat display there.
All right. Well, thank you for that story, Randy. And David, as we wind up here, Randy did talk about one of the options that people who are opposed to the hunt have raised. Why not just, get people to close the all-you-can-eat buffet, have them secure their garbage cans, don't put the grease out where it can be gotten at by the animals. You don't think that's a good option? Why not?
No, well, I think it's a great option. I think people should do it, should try to fence their vegetable gardens to the extent that they can, understanding that deer can easily jump 6-foot fences. They should try to secure their cans if they live in an area with bears or raccoons. But the point of this is, let's suppose that with a click of our fingers, we could eliminate the access to these human food sources for all these wildlife. What would happen next? Starvation of millions of animals. And that's not necessarily a humane way of dealing with the problem either. The natural, untouched, unhuman, habitat is not large enough or sufficient to support these populations. We know that because before any humans were on this continent or any large numbers of humans were on this continent, the natural habitat here supported much smaller populations of these animals than live here now.
David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been speaking to David Vandrili, editor-at-large for Time magazine. His article in this month's issue of Time is called America's Pest Problem.